So we're going to move on now and finish out talking about prostate cancer. And Emmanuel, maybe you can just sort of, again, provide a little bit of an overview of sort of the genomic profile of patients with prostate cancer and what we know about the impact of PARP inhibitors right now.
So one interesting thing about prostate cancer is that BRCA2 is way more common than BRCA1. We have about a 8 to 10% germline BRCA2 rate, but about a 1% germline BRCA1 rate. At the somatic level, it's the same. BRCA2 is about 5 to 10 times more common than BRCA1. So even though in other cancers like breast, ovarian, it's an even split between 1 and 2, in prostate cancer, it's very much dominated by BRCA2. As we mentioned before, overall, 20 to 25% are going to have a somatic HRR mutation. About 10 to 12% are going to have a germline mutation. In May of 2020, we had two PARP inhibitors, Neil, that were approved for metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer. And the first was rucaparib, and the second was olaparib. And, you know, it caught me by surprise because rucaparib was the one that was approved on a single-arm phase 2 study without a comparator arm. And I was frankly shocked. You know, the FDA has never done that in this disease. And then olaparib was approved 4 days later based on a randomized phase 3 study. And there are differences between the two, and I'm not going to go through all the trial designs because we don't have much time left. But the two key differences are the genetic mutation spectrum that is permitted for the use of each drug. So let's start with rucaparib because it's simpler. For rucaparib, this drug is indicated for patients that have a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation only. This can be a germline or a somatic, but it does not cover the other HRR genes. It has to be BRCA1 or 2. The other nuance is that in the FDA label for rucaparib, it says that patients have to have failed at least one taxane for metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer. So it's kind of a second or third line therapy instead of a first or second line castration-resistant prostate cancer therapy. Olaparib, on the other hand, has a 14-gene panel that is included in the FDA label. So it has that broader genomic label. And the other difference is olaparib can also be used before a taxane. You do not have to wait until after a patient has failed the taxane.
So can you talk a little bit about sort of the natural history of prostate cancer and some of the interventions that we're using both in M0 disease when you have a PSA only evidence of disease as well as actual metastatic disease? And right now and today, where you start thinking about using a PARP inhibitor?
So in prostate cancer, we basically have two pillars. The first is to target the androgen receptor, and we have a number of hormone therapies that we use. And the second is chemotherapy, but it's restricted to taxane agents. So we have two drugs, docetaxel and cabazitaxel. Traditionally, it's interesting, platinums have not really worked that well, but in retrospect, they work very well in about 5 to 10% of patients, and maybe these are the same patients that are PARP inhibitor sensitive. We have this distinction between the so-called M0 castration resistant and the M1 castration resistant. It all has to do with when the physician or the provider decides to start the hormone therapy. If the hormone therapy is started in the non-metastatic state, then that person will almost inevitably develop non-metastatic castration-resistant disease 3 to 5 years after the hormone therapy started. If the hormone therapy is deferred until the onset of metastatic disease, then that patient will develop mCRPC, which is metastatic castration-resistant. The PARP inhibitors are not approved for the non-metastatic patients, so they have to be metastatic, and they have to be metastatic castration-resistant. And in the case of rucaparib, they also have to additionally have received a taxane agent. That is not a requirement for olaparib.
So, Joyce, I'm curious what your thoughts are about some of the research going on in prostate cancer. You know, kind of, I think a little bit about prostate and breast are both hormonally related, obviously different diseases. But one, I'm curious what your thoughts are about some of the research going on in prostate cancer. Emmanuel presented a patient who was on a clinical trial who had a BRCA germline mutation. And as part of this trial, the patient actually got a PARP inhibitor and not endocrine therapy, which would have been standard of care. Everybody on the panel when we heard this case was like, could not believe. I mean, imagine breast cancer not giving hormonal therapy, but giving a PARP inhibitor.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is research and exciting. The case he presented went into complete remission. It was amazing. Emmanuel, wow. Can you talk a little bit about where you see things heading? And even the possibility combining hormonal therapy and PARP together.
You know, Neil, we have to be careful about using drugs with unknown toxicities in cancers that have a 7-10 year life expectancy. The patient that I presented, I have to be very clear, this was a clinical trial, and he had a germline mutation and a second hit in the tumor, so he had a complete inactivation. We call that a biallelic inactivation, and it was in the context of a trial, and he could always receive the hormone therapy on the back end if the PARP inhibitor didn't work. But the concern is, let's say there's a 1% MDS AML risk. Well, that risk is going to be compounded in someone that has a 7-10 year life expectancy, which is the usual case even for metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer, versus a patient who is in the second, third, or fourth line CRPC. One of the questions that you raised, Neil, is really one that I have focused on in my research is, can we cure a small percentage of these patients who otherwise have a worse prognosis? And can we turn a worse prognosis into a better prognosis? And here I'm going to use the breast cancer analogy with the HER2 amplification. And before we had trastuzumab, et cetera, and all the new stuff that I don't even know about because it was after my fellowship, T-DM1 and those issues, you know, we used to always say that the HER2 positive breast cancers had a worse natural history. Then we had the HER2 targeting agent, and all of a sudden those ladies had a better prognosis. So could we take a BRCA1 or BRCA2 positive prostate cancer, which has a worse natural history, and convert that patient paradoxically into a person with a better prognosis, not by using a PARP inhibitor alone, but by combining your best systemic hormone therapy, let's say androgen deprivation plus enzalutamide, plus a PARP inhibitor. And interestingly enough, there are companies like Pfizer who have enzalutamide and talazoparib. So those companies could do those studies. If they have not done those yet, I don't think they are as bold as we would have liked them to be. I'm sorry to say if there's any pharmaceutical people on the call. But those studies absolutely need to be done. And in those patients, we might actually cure a small subset with maximizing the systemic therapy, giving it for a finite amount of time, and then stopping all therapy in the complete responders.
Incidentally, you got to send me a link of your band, Guy. I want to hear your music. Anyhow, Joyce, any thoughts? Maybe close out. I'd like to get the investigators to comment on kind of where they see the excitement moving forward. Joyce, you hear a lot about the idea of combining things. What are some of the trial concepts in PARP inhibitors? It's interesting. Emmanuel brought up HER2, and even in HER2, we're seeing HER2 treatments being used in gastric cancer, being used in colon cancer. So kind of similar to PARP, you know, same kind of drug, but used based on the marker. Where do you see things heading in breast cancer, Joyce?
Well, I think the concept of synthetic lethality is one that the PARP inhibitors really give us a beautiful window into. I'm sitting here, I love to hear about other cancers, I really do, and I'm sneaking a little peek as we're sitting here about cediranib suppressing homologous recombination repair because it downregulates BRCA1 and 2 and RAD51, and you combine that in ovarian cancer with olaparib and you've got a major home run. So I think, as we were just hearing from Emmanuel too, you know, it may be that AR inhibition, because AR leads to the transcription of a whole bunch of these HR proteins, you know, and it acts as a scaffold so that other ones can pile on. Let's do some synthetic lethality.
So Katie, again, in ovarian cancer, we've made this huge step forward, but the disease still has a way to go. What are you excited about in terms of clinical research involving PARP inhibitors?
I mean, I'm excited and pleased with what we've accomplished thus far. I've been following the chat and people were interested in overall survival, which of course don't have in the front line yet, but I would remind you all that we did get overall survival from SOLO2, which was second or third line maintenance, which despite 35% crossover to PARP had an overall survival advantage of about 13 months.
That was just presented at the ASCO meeting a couple of weeks ago. And it was kind of shocking to me. This is a relapse setting. And they saw a pretty significant survival benefit.
Unadjusted for the appropriate crossover in the placebo group. So about 38% got in a PARP appropriately after.
And they still live longer getting it earlier.
Correct. I think that's the message, that the earlier you use it, the better. So there is the clinical biomarker of being platinum sensitive that we don't have in the front line. We don't have that clinical biomarker, but we do have at least BRCA. And so I think a lot of time will still tell for SOLO1. We're years away from an overall survival readout. But I'm excited about that. We have iMMagine-50 is getting close to an answer. So that's atezolizumab and bevacizumab. So a non-PARP story to talk about. And we'll see. I honestly do not know the results. I'm the international PI of that. But I hope it's positive. And if it's positive, how do we integrate that into the treatment paradigm for patients? We're going to figure that out. So I'm excited that we're making progress. I'm excited that we're really starting. We're not there yet to individualize therapy for patients with ovarian cancer by biomarkers. I don't think the current HRD assay is anywhere near where we need it to be to accurately identify folks who will and won't benefit from PARP. And so as such, I'm glad that there's an all-comers indication that we can make decisions as providers. But I am excited about the studies that are ongoing, and the more science we learn, I think the more scientifically driven our trials become. So there's a lot of progress that's been made, but we're kind of at the new floor and we still have a ways to go.
Thanks so much to the faculty for joining us tonight. Thank you for dialing in.